Okay, welcome to episode 59 of the Now at the Moment weekly Alexis L podcast, which just features me and Talal. Seems to be partly about politics, partly about movies. And I think we'll decide on what movie we're all going to collectively watch today. I don't think we've...
Oh, we'll decide
some,
today.
There's been some suggestions.
Well, there has been.
We've all seen probably the movie. You know, we could talk about some movies. But I thought there was an idea that we collectively watch a movie. Or I don't know.
Yeah, that was the idea, yeah.
Yeah. In an informal sort of way.
But then we'll talk... Things. Go on.
No, we'll just saying a couple...
After you. No, please.
I was just going to say a couple of things I remember. I forgot to mention last week. I thought about... the US elections, one of the things that was ironical, of course, was that Kamala Harris had the help of over 100 Labour apparatchiks, didn't she, from the British Labour Party.
Oh.
And including that little shitbag, Jonathan Ashworth. And, well, I suppose we could talk about, I mean, I suppose, I don't know. But, I mean, I just one of the things that struck me that I was thinking about was just how, and this seemed to be following the Hillary Clinton playbook, and other people have mentioned it, was that use of celebrities, really, which I think, you know, Bruce Springsteen and Beyonce. Taylor Swift and that Beyonce and the Beha. I mean, just I think it just must annoy people. I sort of think, you used to tell me to fucking vote, you wealthy bloody person. You know, I think that, I mean, because Hillary Clinton had all that.
I want a union member up there telling me how to vote, billionaire.
Well, I don't know. It seems wrong. I think, it clearly was part of a losing strategy. Just another thing that I thought was that, so there's a lot of, you know, in the kind of fixing the reasons for why the Democrats failed, that I've seen a lot of kind of centrist commentary saying that, well, you know, incumbents everywhere have lost, you know, Schultz in Germany and Macron, and even though Macron would bloody go, even though the left had won a majority, but, you know, incumbents, Biden, you know, one of those articles
means like the person who's currently the leader.
Yeah. So they're just saying because, you know, electorates are turning on the people who impact. One example that they consistently fail to mention is Mexico, where the government of AMLO, Luis Obrador, a good friend of Jeremy Corbyn, left power. And, you know, handed over to his left-wing deputy or left-wing president now, Anna Sheinbaum, I think she's called. She's got an 80% approval rating. So you've had a left-wing government, an incumbent left-wing government in Mexico, which succeeded by an even more popular left-wing government. And the reason for that is clearly, you know, egalitarian policies, you know, attempt to redistribute wealth, you know, an attempt to fight corruption, and you know, a genuinely populist in the real sense of the word approach to the people, genuine democracy, attempt to reform the kind of reactionary judicial system. I think. I mean, I don't know a huge amount about Mexican policies. We've seen a government with explicitly left wing policies. Succeeded by another government with explicitly left-wing policies. And of course, these Polly Toynbees of this world fail to mention that because it doesn't fit in with their despicable philosophy of kind of the only way you can win is centrism, really. So I just wanted to mention that.
Or the centrists would rather have the far right win than anyone on the left. What's the latest in Venezuela? Are you up to date with that?
I don't know enough about Venezuela. I don't know whether...
Who are the people currently in charge?
Oh, I see. Well, Maduro took over from Chavez.
Was that the goodie or the baddie?
Well, I don't know. I think you'd have to. I mean, a lot of Maduro and Chavez before him were painted as left wing baddies, really. I mean, and certainly the United States, with the cooperation of Britain, tried to stage a sort of coup a few years ago, where they plucked this nobody from the legislature and tried to pretend that he was the president. I don't know that the legacy media here suggests that. The result was fixed, or the Venezuelan elections. I doubt that they were, but I must say, I've always, Chavez used to do it, and I think Maduro does it. Somebody who gives like speeches that go on for 3 hours, I'm always suspicious of, really. You know what I mean?
And let's not forget the Brazilians voted the lefty.
The Brazilians also, you got Lula in Brazil. Again, I mean,
he
really
seems a nice guy.
Yeah, and leading the economy in Southern America, and that is a country that's gone left wing. So it's not. I mean, he took over from Bolsonaro. I don't know. You know, hopefully that Lula's. Not Lula. Lula's rule will continue. I just wanted to mention that about Mexico anyway. Mm-hmm. Maduro, I think, I don't know. I'm not sure about Maduro or Chavez before them, really. The listeners, somebody will probably be an expert on Venezuela. It's certainly not as the kind of the mainstream media presents it. I think there is. I remember seeing I can't remember his name now, Guido, I think he was called, tried to kind of take a coup. They had an academic on, sort of lists of people who are only getting on the television once and in the afternoon on News 24, and they're pushing this line that this guy was the legitimate president. You know, and this academic from Sheffield or somewhere he said no, the army is very strong, the idea of la patria, of the country, is very strong, that the whatever the internal problems are of Venezuela, that the army and the people will stand with Maduro, really. And this, and that was that guy was very quietly dropped. But I think it is. I mean, again, and why, whatever the state of Venezuela is, why there are sanctions, U.S. sanctions against it, is absurd. When we don't sanction like Saudi, it's a country.
It's all about the money, baby.
Yeah, but it's a country where women are, where women are allowed to drive and so on. It's not like Saudi Arabia. Why not sanction them?
No, women can drive in Saudi now.
Sure. Because I think, but the woman who campaigned for that is languishing in prison for like the fifth year in a row. But if any of our listeners know more,
give us some insight.
Venezuela, I would be glad to hear from them. All right.
So at the end of the last episode, we left on a major cliffhanger, Alexei. Yeah, it was huge. You started going on about Liverpool, and how it had been. You were saying stuff about Liverpool that I'm not familiar with at all. So I thought maybe you could enlighten me and the audience about what happened there. You said everything got demolished.
Yeah.
They kind of got rid of old Liverpool.
Yeah.
Liverpool you grew up in is not really what it looks like anymore?
No.
Please share.
So there is a book that they're asking to send me called, which I've seen mention of, which is called Liverpool and the Unmaking of Britain by a guy called Sam Weatherall. And I think it is about that, how Liverpool's kind of history, it says it explores the epic history of Liverpool since the Second World War, from its promising rise to its disastrous decline. Liverpool became a prism through which recent British history is brought into a new focus and provides an insight into what the future may hold for many more communities. I assume it will. It sounds like an interesting book. I think they're going to send me. So it's called Sam Weatherall, Liverpool and the Unmaking of Britain. I think they're going to send me a copy of that. Presumably it also focuses on the catastrophic redevelopment. I mean, there was an interesting article I think it was by the Guardian's, I can't remember, who was it by? No, it was somebody. No, it might have been Simon Jenkins, that's right. He was writing about how he was at like a conference of architects in the 60s or 70s, and they were talking about, you know, every city was going to essentially was going to be demolished and motorways were going to be driven through the center of them. And that to a degree that actually, and it was this extraordinary arrogance of architects and town planners and kind of top down, you know, people were either housed in these terrible kind of Le Corbusier style blocks of flats, or they were moved out to these distant housing estates with no facilities. And it was catastrophic, really. And it was funny that there's also this graphic novel Chris Shepherd called Anfield Road, which is kind
Anfield,
of that's Anfield it. Road, which is sort of backdrop for that. But it was like, and I can remember that because Anfield Road, in the way our road, we lived off Anfield Road, and our house, and it was like we lived on the side that wasn't the rest from the other side of Anfield Road. No, Oakfield Road. That went through Everton and to terraced houses. Eventually he got to the city and the river. And our side of the street was sort of left alone, but the other side of the street was just rubble. I mean, it was reduced to rubble from Oakfield Road into the city centre, more or less. All the houses were demolished.
To what end? For how long were they rubble?
Years. When I did that comic Roots, which was 1982, I think we filmed it on the in my own. It was rubble for years, and then very slowly, kind of, you know, just grass grew, I suppose, and then, you know, system built flats were sort of erected in a kind of haphazard fashion, and I think it's still a bit. I mean, it's still, I think. It's not a cityscape, you know. I mean, it's funny, you watch like coverage of Spain or something, and even when the buildings are modern, they're built on a conventional street layout, you know. Apartments, shops at the bottom, narrow roads, big main roads, you know, whereas just the way that British cities were developed was just this disastrous, brutal, I mean, really... you know, and I think it was Simon Jenkins. I can't remember. You know, he was standing, you're watching people in tears being kind of put on buses and taken away from their homes. And, you know, particularly the terrible block of flats in her estate in Manchester.
An initiative to like modernize the cities or?
Yeah. I mean, I suppose you didn't see it because you lived in Ealing, and Ealing, I mean, London kind of escaped.
You have in London is that, you know, 80% of the high streets look identical and have the same shops in them.
Yes, but at least there are high streets. If you can imagine in Liverpool, there weren't even any high streets. It was just, you know, paths through the rubble, really. And there's just an extraordinary amount of beauty was destroyed. And it happened in Birmingham, it happened in Manchester, it happened in Leeds, it happened in Liverpool, you know, to a greater or lesser extent. And it's that is the backdrop of the 70s and the 80s, really. I mean, extraordinary cruel, and often done by the Labour Party.
Well, because, yeah, towards the end of the 70s is when you had, was it the summer or the winter of discontent, when everyone kind of just had enough? And then that led to Thatcher winning a huge majority.
Thatcher mixed up? Winter of discontent was 1974. Thatcher came to power in 1979.
Okay. All these things are... That
in a sense was about a different thing, but certainly I remember, I mean, the debt that was, you know, the money that was borrowed to sweep away all this beauty and community, all these working class communities, was the money was borrowed presumably and took a long, you know, was made a major dent in the city's finances. And, you know, it was just, I mean, it, you know, there were slums, but, you know, I mean, what, nobody suggests you knock down Naples and build tower. I mean, there were, you could have taken those Victorian houses and just installed bathrooms and central heating, and you didn't have to demolish miles on miles of them. And that's what they did, really. But there's some interesting, people should read about it, really, because it was a kind of collective trauma, which, you know, was only really experienced by the working class, particularly in the north, that has never really been articulated, I think, you know.
That's is there, maybe when we do our live show up in Liverpool, there'll be someone local who we can talk to about that.
Yeah,
in the live
people
show.
I mean, people don't really. People say, "Oh, look." I mean, there's. I mean, there is sort of a lot. There's in some bits. There's a lot left. I mean, in like the, you know, what do you call the Georgian Quarter now? What was Liverpool 8 Toxteth? There's, you know, there's a lot of fine Georgian architecture left. But there was so, you know. There was just so much more. If I would like one northern, I think if there's any, I might be wrong about this. I always got the feeling that if there was any northern city that sort of escaped the wholesale redevelopment, it was Hull, really, because Hull was a kind of a peninsula and a backwater and didn't have the money to do these kind of wholesale redevelopments. Right. And that Hull, I don't know what Hull is like now, but it seemed to me when I visited there, that it was a more, that it was a town that had more architecture, you know.
I was in Skegness recently.
Oh, right.
Doesn't look like they've been redeveloped for a while.
No, well, there you go. Some seaside towns, yeah. But you think you go through to BBC in Manchester, you know, you think Salford was the centre of British working class consciousness, you know. It was in the centre of the Industrial Revolution. It doesn't,
yeah.
That's Maxine Peake. There doesn't seem to be any of it left, really. It's just terrible kind of housing estates. And you think about how, you know, any other, certainly any other European country would not have done that. France, Spain, Italy would not have.
They value the historic buildings more than that. Yeah, there's so little. Again, it's the fucking people with money would just do anything to make more of it and not.
They'll fight
tooth and nail to like reduce the heritage status of a building just so they could fucking build a shopping center there or something. You said I grew up in Ealing. There's this place in Ealing now called Filmworks.
Right.
And it's like a very modern kind of cinema with a mini kind of shopping center built into it, a few cafes and stuff. But it used to be our local cinema, and it was a listed grade two listed building. It's like this. Because, you know, it's right around the corner from Ealing Studios, and it used to be the hub of UK cinema was Ealing. And this, they built back in the heyday of cinema in the 30s or whatever, they built this fucking gorgeous mini multiplex cinema. It's got like four screens in it or something. Mm-hmm. And the front facing side of the building has all this detail and, you know, sconces and like little gargoyles and these beautiful two massive like Hollywood style pillars at the front of the building. And it had been, they just shut it down suddenly one day, and it'd been shut and left empty for years. I used to go there every week with my dad as a kid, and then in my teens or late teens they just shut it, and it had been shut for like close to 15 years. And it was a similar story to Battersea Power Station. It was just like loads of people fighting over what they want to do with it. But in the end, and I wish Liverpool had a similar kind of team kind of caring about the buildings, because in the end, the council just fought so hard for them not to knock it down.
Really? Wow.
Because everyone just wanted to knock it the fuck down
and
build whatever, a fucking Primark there or whatever. And they're like, no. And the front-facing side of the building was protected by law. They fought hard to make sure that, at the very least, the front side of the building with the pillars and the detail and all that, they're like, you can't touch that.
Right.
So it's now become a really modern cinema. So it's still a cinema after 20 years of battles.
Yeah.
And you, the front of it still looks the same. But then if you go around the back, it's all like metal and shiny and all that. But at least Ealing had our council
Protect
that, you know.
Well done, Ealing. Well, again, I didn't live in Liverpool through those years, but I visited because my mum lived there and Linda's parents lived there. So it was an era I would go back nearly every week. But if somebody else has got another, there may be people listening who fought to preserve. There may be people who've got a different view on that, really. But, you know, anyway. We should, and we talk about doing a podcast. There was an interesting place in Tubruch that it's not going to happen right away, but we'll maybe do a live podcast up there at some point. Yeah.
Well, the one I sent you.
Yeah.
You like the look of it?
Yeah. It's fine. 100. Yeah. Why not? It's nearer. Yeah. Because Tubruch's nearer where I grew up, really. So be interesting from that point of view.
We could do two shows there over a weekend.
Yeah.
Film a bike ride up in Liverpool.
Yeah.
Someone messaged asking why we haven't done a bike ride for a while. Have we given up on it completely?
Yeah, I couldn't sort of. It's my fault. I haven't got the enthusiasm for it. So, I mean, it felt like we did a few electric ones, didn't they, when they gave us them bikes.
Mm-hmm.
And that piece of kit that you got, that the sort of
the camera, the 360
advanced
camera
thing, the 360 is much better than the GoPros that we used to have. But I don't. I suddenly felt I didn't have anything to, I'd sort of done that already.
Well, we did bike ride to Gaza one, the one where we cycled to the protest.
True, yeah.
And that was beautiful. And that's one of our most successful ones in terms of viewership.
Yeah.
And I thought it was really nice. And I'm starting to get better at editing with that camera because it was really tricky. So we got that camera when we got the electric bikes, it's so weird having, can you imagine having 360 degree footage? You know, my whole life I've been editing just a square of image, you know, and suddenly you've got this wraparound weird video and you're like, what do I do with it? Yeah. Where do I point it? And it's like, it's a lot to take in and think about while you're editing. But by the time we did the road to Gaza one, I think I simplified it down and it made it look nice because when we were, not.
Maybe think about it. I mean, it felt like it was a kind of lock. I mean, it was big during lockdown, wasn't it? Because
it was the lockdown bike ride is how it started.
Yeah.
But my point is, I think when we have an occasion or a destination that really drives us to do a bike ride.
Yeah.
Rather than having you aimlessly wander around random streets and pulling stories out your butt. Because the Gaza one, you had something you wanted to say.
Yes.
You had somewhere to go, and that's what made it, I think, quite substantial.
Yeah.
So that's why I think, next time we're in a location like Liverpool or something, we'll do another one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay, would you like some more questions from listeners?
I'll just say there was, this is the insider film, Gus. There was a film, I think it was on the telly. There was a film on the telly the night called Midas Man, which was about Brian Epstein, the Beatles manager. It was a distant relative of mine.
Ooh.
And it was pretty dreadful, really. Pretty banal, kind of. And they also, each of the Beatles, there's a lot of films, but each of the Beatles like looked like who they were playing, but only from one angle. But I remember I was offered the part of Alan Williams, the Beatles' previous manager, the man who lost the Beatles. And they said, half a day's filming, you have to shave your beard off. So I said, no, I won't bother. I'm not going to bother. But so when I watched it on the telly, I didn't watch all of it. When I watched it on telly, Eddie Izzard was playing that part anyway.
Playing the part you were meant to
Go for. Playing Alan Williams, yeah. Well,
that's funny.
Yeah. It's a pretty shit film, really. You know, it's a sort of. And also, of course, they don't have the rights to any of the music, so it's fine if it's in the early years when they're playing Little Richard songs and stuff. it's fine, but once they get into the way the Beatles started writing their own songs, they suddenly become curiously mute.
Did you used to watch Eddie Izzard's comedy specials, the ones from like the 90s?
You didn't really. I think I'll take the Fifth Amendment on that one.
Oh, okay. All right. We've had seeing we're doing these weekly, I've been putting out on our Instagram at AlexisLPod. If you want to follow us on Instagram at AlexisLPod, putting out a call out for any questions and stuff. And seeing as we're talking about films, someone asked, when was the last time you went to the cinema?
What did you see? It's one of them things. We went to see American Fiction, which incredible. I really liked. And Linda's a big fan of the author of something Everett, isn't he? His politics seemed pretty good as well. I thought it was really good. I haven't been back since. I'm a member of the Curzon Cinema, mostly because that means I get 10% off buying a coffee there.
Oh.
In the Brunswick.
Yeah, they're nice cinemas.
Yeah.
American Fiction was splendid.
Yeah.
I recommend anyone watch that. It's just a profoundly interesting way to talk about race and diversity and assimilation.
Yeah.
And
yeah. But I should go more, really. But
yeah, right. Last thing I saw was Dune 2. That was ages.
It was a question somewhere, wasn't it? But yeah, I had Dune 2 on my computer, and it was away filming, and it was the only film I had, so I've watched it about four times. I really like it, and it's about anti-colonialism, isn't it? Really, it's about an anti-colonial struggle. Really,
100%. I love everything about those films, apart from the fact that the people who are clearly meant to be the Arabs are all played by Mexicans. It's
right.
and South Americans and mixed
right.
And mixed race people.
Right, right.
You know, because it's clearly about oil and the Middle East and the fight over imperial control over the Middle East and the oil flow and stuff. Like it's kind of clear, the analogy there.
Yeah. I don't know if Frank Herbert saw it that way, but certainly. Zendaya's people they all dress like Arabs, don't they? Really?
That's the thing. Yeah. It's not just, it's not just there's, but loosely the idea of, they dress like Arabs and they're nomadic. Yeah. And, they sit around drinking coffee, really strong coffee. They fight. They live in the desert. They, it's like everything is Arab, 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 Arab,
yeah.
Mexicans, right. which winds me up. But the cast are really good, so I'll let them off.
They are really good. I think I'd seen part one once. I think I went back and watched that again, and presumably it's a part three in the works.
Yeah. They're amazing cinema experiences.
And they also, I suppose, it's a bit like Henry V or something. It's also about, I should see it. Should have seen it in the cinema, really, because I imagine it's magnificent. But it's also about because at the end of the second one, he has taken on the mantle of the sort of the leader, hasn't he? But that means that he is now distanced from, like, Zendaya and the people who got him to that point, really.
Yeah.
Rather like in Shakespeare's Henry V, when Henry V, having become king, turns on his old pals.
Right.
Like Falstaff and, becomes this kind of, very fanatical. Well, not fanatical, but I mean, becomes a, takes on the mantle of kinghood and casts off his younger.
Or like, I'm not familiar with Henry the, which one was it? Fifth.
Henry the Fifth.
I've not read or seen. I'm a bit intimidated by Shakespeare, to be completely frank.
Yeah, we went to see Coriolanus as well at the National Theatre.
Disgusting.
Coriolanus. What's disgusting? That joke.
Sounds pornographic.
With David Holloway, which is, it's not a great play really, but. That's
a really, but that's a really interesting parallel with Dune as well. And it's like so many leftist revolutionaries who organize an amazing coup and then become horrible dictators themselves.
Absolutely, yeah.
As you've seen in the Middle East countless times.
Yes.
South America and stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. But again, also, he's the white man who becomes the leader of all the Arabs, quote unquote.
Timothy Chalamet. Yeah. Yes, I suppose so. There is that.
Did you hear about this New York Timothy Chalamet lookalike competition?
I only saw the headlines in the paper.
Last month.
And
it was a hilarious sequence of events. They kept getting kicked out of venues. They were trying to organize it at these different venues, and too many people came. For some reason, it was just this huge buzz about it. And so they got shut down multiple times. They ended up doing it in a park. The police came and kicked them out of the park. So they did it in a third or fourth location, finally. And the grand prize for the winner was $50. $50. Yeah. And then when they announced the winner, it turned out Timothy Chalamet had been hiding in the audience with a cap and sunglasses the whole time, and came up and took a picture with
himself. Because there's apocryphal stories about people entering, I don't know.
You
know.
Entering their own lookalike
contest and coming third.
And then he came up, took a picture with the winner, and then got chased by the crowd through the park. And there are just many great posts about it. And you're not on any social media, are you?
Do you
ever, like, without an account, go and browse on them? Do you have an
account
on your phone?
Very rarely, very occasionally.
I'm curious about this because as a Palestine supporter who is on Instagram, my algorithm feeds me lots of Palestine stuff. And I see supposedly things that they don't show on mainstream media, which is what they all say. Mainstream media won't show you this. Mainstream media won't show you that. However, I don't consume much mainstream media at all.
Right.
So that, and it's kind of bad, and it's something I want to change, but it tends to be my main source of news is through social media and YouTube or whatnot. But I do see on Instagram lots, countless images and photographs and videos of, you know, all the injured children and people under the rubble and babies with their heads blown off. Literally, you know, you see images of dismembered and horribly injured and dead young people and older people, everything. Mm. Constantly in my algorithm being fed to me.
And why would I want to see that?
Well, I guess, they say bear witness. They say we should all bear witness. And not, you know, but that's not the point. My question was gonna be, so you do not see that stuff personally?
No, I avoid it really. I mean, it's a deliberate act. I feel bad enough as it is. So I think if I saw that stuff as well, I don't know if I could. Yeah. Really, you know, it would just kind of do me in completely, I think. So no, and Linda won't let me go on social media. She says I wouldn't last 5 minutes. Mm-hmm. You know.
So where do you get your Palestine news from?
I have a couple of websites I sort of look at, like Squawk Box or Jewish Voice for Labor, or so they're all, you know, they're always pretty good. And just YouTube, really, just looking at videos on YouTube, but people talking rather than massacres. But it is an interesting, I mean, certainly if you don't watch mainstream media, it's certainly the whole Israeli, the Maccabi Tel Aviv supporters. I mean, that was a prime example of mainstream media lying. I mean, that there was a little bit of Sky News at the start said these people are violent, racist hooligans. They rioted on the Tuesday night, I think it was, attacked Palestinian flag, homes firing Palestinian flags, chanted death to the Arabs. And then that was all. Then the narrative changed because Israel and Israelis have to be presented entirely as victims, can only be presented, can never be presented as instigators of violence, because as the racists that they really are, because then the whole narrative of Israel as the innocent victim would come tumbling down. Really. So, yeah, there's an egregious example where Sky News had a relatively factual report and they took it down.
Yeah, they took it down, re-edited it to change the story and put it back up again.
And then they took that down, I think. But that is a prime example of the and also the Western, Starmer issuing, has never issued a denunciation of children being, hospitals, children being set on fire outside hospitals. But, Starmer and Lammy managed to steer themselves from the trough that they're in to, condemn that, and the mayor of Amsterdam saying, we've failed the Jewish people, bullshit. And it was, a prime example, really, of the hypocrisy and the lies of mainstream media. And I think a lot of people these days were able to see the truth, the true narrative, And, some of the, media, I think Channel 4 still sort of hinted at it a bit, but it's all a lie, man. It's all,
do you read all the papers as well?
No, I just get The Guardian online, really, and I look at that.
Right.
Get annoyed. And my phone gives me The Telegraph, which is just full of kind of the most demented right-wing bullshit.
But they've kind of gone extra right-wing, haven't they?
Yeah, because I used to write for The Telegraph as I was a motoring correspondent. Some people sometimes, when they want to, people who don't like me, they'll say, "Still writing for The Telegraph, Alexei?" To which the answer is, no. No, I'm not, no. But there was a point when I thought that, I was only a motoring correspondent anyway, but... there was a point when The Telegraph was reasonably sane. I mean, in the sense that you would get the right-wing nonsense on one page, but on the other page, there'd be somebody relatively liberal. But then when the Barclay brothers took it over in 2012, which is when I got fired, it then became, from then on, became insanely right-wing.
Really. Right.
And now it's just dumb.
Now
it's
even disgusting. Even the motoring articles are right wing.
Well, all that. I mean, it used to be this lavish kind of motor. I mean, all that's died, really. There was a really lavish supplement, full color supplement within the Saturday paper. Of course, the economics of that.
Oh, right.
Collapsed, really.
Dave Allen. I'm going to listener questions now. Dave Allen's biography or autobiography? They say biography, but you get several positive mentions.
Do
that.
I?
Is it reciprocated? And who's Dave Allen?
Well, Dave Allen was a very rare example, really, of a comedian who was big on the telly in the 60s, 70s, I suppose, but he wasn't really a racist. He had... I think he'd been like I don't know whether he was a chat show host or a journalist or something in Ireland, but he would do these. I was missing half of one finger. I don't remember.
Dave Allen, yes, Irish ex-Catholic.
So he would do these kind of monologues. Yeah,
he'd sit in his armchair with a glass of brandy or something,
and then he'd do sketches as well. I think.
Yeah.
I mean, he was certainly a rare, he was a big, rare kind of outlier from people like Bernard Manning and Jim Davis.
Yes. And he gave off the energy of a kind man.
Yeah. I think Barry Cryer used to write a lot for him. And I didn't think his stuff was like super funny, really, if I'm honest, but.
Oh,
you know,
my father used to love him, and we had he would sit me down and we'd watch it.
Yeah.
When it was on telly, him the two Ronnies and.
Yeah.
But my dad was a huge.
Ronnie B and Ronnie C. We're more mainstream, really.
Yeah.
But yeah, they managed to avoid most of them.
But did you have, it's all coming back to, I absolutely adore Dave Allen. I thought his stories were really funny, especially stories about the Catholic school and the nuns and stuff that he grew up with. And he was very anti-church. And
I never liked him that much at the time, but that might be an example of me being a prick.
So you knew him? You worked with him?
I didn't know him at all. Never met him, no. But, I mean, he was, when I was, like, still, you know, washing dishes or working on building sites or whatever, you know, I mean, that was his heyday. I wasn't in the business when...
But you get several positive mentions in his biography.
I feel guilty now for not liking him more. I'd be interested to see his stuff again, really, because I'd probably be in a bit of a gip by not liking him. Even before I was in the entertainment business, that's strange.
That is
strange preferences.
So it's a biography, not an autobiography. It's called Dave Allen, The Biography, written by Carolyn Suter. I'm curious to read that now because if you're mentioned in it, I'll report back to you, okay? When I get around to reading it in about six fucking months. I'm so slow at reading. All right. That's really nice to hear. That was from Make It Jones, that question, and he's the fella who made those little Lego right. Alexis.
Right.
Okay. How many languages, this is fun, how many languages can you count to 10 in?
Oh my God! Probably not to ten. I can
do one. Can you do Spanish? Surely you can do Spanish.
Uno, dos, tres, cuatro, cinco, seis, siete,
ocho,
nueve días.
Amazing, Alexi.
Muchas gracias.
Really nice. Okay, do French.
Un, deux, trois, quatre, cinq,
six,
sept, huit, neuf.
Yeah.
What's ten? Dix.
Amazing. Really good. Right. Love it.
And now Klingon. Ach, clock, clock, black, black, clock, clock.
Really?
Mack.
German?
Eins, zwei, drei, vier, fünf, sechs, sieben, acht, neun, zehn.
Whoa!
German seems to come very naturally to me. I don't know why.
Can you do Russian?
What the hell's that about?
That's crazy, yeah. That was like...
Where did that come from?
That was a Manchurian Candidate fucking level. Yeah. Just had been untapped from
that
your brain.
That just came right from the kind of back of the brain for no reason. That's weird.
You must know Russian.
That's crazy. No, I don't know.
From your heritage, no?
No. I was watching on Amazon. I apologize for mentioning Amazon. The delivery apps are available. There was a film about, there's a Russian film about this kind of highly romanticized story about, it's called Kalashnikov. AK-47, it's about the story of Kalashnikov and the making of the AK-47. Whoa. I wouldn't recommend it, but...
When you said romanticize, I was...
Well, you know, yeah.
Is it? Probably. It's not a romance film, I'm imagining.
No, there was a bit of romance in it, actually, yeah.
Oh?
Yeah.
Can you do Arabic?
No, I used to be able to, but I can't now.
Wahid. 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. I've had a couple questions about this Lint Cafe in Sydney. There was a bomber or something. Did you hear about this?
No, I didn't hear about this.
Neither did I. It was two people have asked about it. I'm going to look it up and we'll talk about
it.
Night Voice, I've had a couple questions about.
Night Voice.
Ask Alexi about Night Voice, his best ever acting role.
Yeah.
Did you have much say in the character?
Yeah.
I don't know what Night Voice is. Can you give us some context, please?
I was a sort of shabby, late night sort of talk jock in, I think it was Sheffield. Sort of sad man, and I somehow got involved. And it was a really good piece of acting, but I mean, it was one of those things. I think it was film two, and I was very excited when it went out, but it sort of didn't really lead to, it was written by a playwright called Dave Shearsby, I think. It didn't really lead to any more or better roles, really. But yeah, I gave it everything. And I've got a long monologue towards the end as the DJ, which I did in one take and got a round of applause off the crew because it was so intense. There was a very young Leslie Sharp on that, who I got friendly with for a while, and Kevin Waitley and Neil Dudgeon, who's now, of course, Midsummer Murders. I agree. It's an interesting piece of work. And I was at my best in a way when I was playing. You know, I could do sad, vulnerable sort of characters, really. And that's who he was. And that's what I enjoyed doing. I got cast a lot as heavies and villains. And I was really poor at that. But
this isn't a movie. This is part of a series called Screenplay.
Screenplay or Screens.
Oh, so these are plays for TV.
They're one-hour films shown on BBC Two, I think.
From 1990, directed by Richard Spence.
Yeah.
Clarence Flamer hosts a late-night talk show on regional radio station North Star Sound. A phone call he takes one night leads to his discovering a mortgage scam being run by a group of estate agents. His attempts to delve deeper have tragic consequences.
Yeah.
Oh. Starring yourself and Kevin Waitley.
Yeah.
Ruth Sheen,
yes.
Mm-mm-mm. Leslie Sharp. Okay, I wonder where we can watch that.
Might be on YouTube or something.
Mm-hmm. Do you agree that this might be your best?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Fascinating stuff. I love getting homework. I'm going to watch that. Okay, moving on. Any interesting stories about Didn't You Kill My Brother?
The film or the song?
It was a film as well?
Yeah, it was a comic strip film. Again, it was a one-hour comic strip film. Starring me playing twin brothers, a sort of homage to the Cray brothers. Interesting stories. There's a young actor on it called Dexter Fletcher, who of course now was in like Band of Brothers and stuff like that. He's now seems to specialize in kind of biopics of sort of 80s, 70s movie stars. He did the Queen one. I think he might have taken that one over, and he did the Elton John one, I think. Remember he had a Land Rover and I had a go in it, and then I bought one. Short wheelbase V8, Rover 90, Land Rover 90. That's not really a very interesting story, is it? I think I see him walking his dog around past my house sometimes. Late Bob Spears directed. Beryl Reed played my mum, played the twins, the most. And Beryl Reed is a really interesting character. It's one of the. She loved me. She'd been a music hall star and then sort of transitioned to acting. And her finest role is probably in the Alec Guinness Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, where she plays the sort of archivist of MI5, MI6. And not the terrible, shitty, bloody Benedict Cumberbatch one, but the Gary Oldman one. But the BBC one, which is really worth watching. She loved me, and she was really always, I mean, she was one of, you know, she was like, you needed to work with her before lunchtime, otherwise she'd be getting, you know, problematic. Well, she loved me so much, and she was always inviting me to her cottage, Honey Pots, on the banks of the Thames. And I never went, really. And I admired her so much as a performer, really. And that's somebody like a working class, somebody who'd come out of the old Victorian music hall almost, and then transition to being an actor. She's a very funny turn as well. She's very funny. And I regret really that. We're in it was Robbie Coltrane's memorial yesterday, day before, in the Actors' Church in Covent Garden. And there was a bench in the garden dedicated to Beryl Reid. And Linda said to me, you should have been nicer to her. And I agreed. And I remember we got her on stuff. And Marcus Mortimer, he's a very, very nice, he's the director, producer, but he was horrible to me. He was a bit mean to Beryl Reid, I remember. I don't know why. I did get her on stuff as well. She's somebody worth looking up.
Who else? Which other comic strip people were in that film? You were all in it, I guess.
No, there wasn't many, actually, because it was when, for some reason, I think Pete's in it. I don't think anybody's in it apart from me, really, and Pete. Briefly. Mm-hmm. Apart from that, it's all... Who else is in it, really? I can't remember who's in it.
So you played twins in it?
Yeah.
And would you have scenes with yourself?
Yeah, which was really difficult to do then on film. You had to, like, the lens had to be blocked out with it. It's so easy now with digital, but... The lens had to be blocked out with a sort of piece of cardboard.
Really? They would cover half the lens?
Yeah, half the lens. That's the only way. And then you take the cardboard off and you'd film the other side of the conversation.
Fuck.
It was really primitive. But yeah, I played scenes where I talked to myself. I don't know what it's like now. It's full of a lot of my themes and obsessions, really. I wrote it with Pauline Melville, who's now an actress and a writer and my dear friend, late David Stafford. I think I don't know that screenwriting is really my strong suit, really. But I think it's an interesting piece of work.
Wrote it as well.
Yeah, well, me and Pauline and David Jam wrote it together. But it's based on, there was a song, I had a hit song. Well, it was a hit in Canada and Australia anyway.
The song came first?
Yeah. Called Didn't You Kill My Brother? Yeah.
But can you tell me more about acting with yourself? Like the method of that, like not just the technical side. I mean, like you're, as an actor, talking to a blank space, right? And then you'd go and film the other side of the conversation.
It's something you'd do. I mean, you know, it was a comic movie, so it wasn't like there was any... I mean, Tom Hardy did it, didn't he, playing both the Kray twins, because it's much easier with digital technology.
I think the hardest bit would be the timing, right? If you're having a conversation with yourself.
Yeah.
And you're supposedly filming it in one shot. So you'd have to time the gaps, leave gaps for yourself.
Somebody else reads in the lines. I think, you know, you're not just acting to a blank, you're acting to just somebody else.
But the pacing, the way they read it, I guess you'd rehearse it a bunch, right?
Yeah. I think I've done that kind of thing a few times, like on stuff and that. It wasn't just a sort of, you know, it's all the magic of cinema, isn't it, really? It's not unheard of. I mean, I know, yeah, I mean, people often, I mean, especially these days, but with digital, you know, people are often having to act to a kind of tennis ball on a stick, aren't they, which is later going to turn into a kind of CGI monster. So I think it just comes with that sort of, that's what acting is, you know, is that kind of nonsense or that kind of magic, you know. It is, you know, giving heart and soul, you know, and giving a really emotional performance to a tennis ball on a stick. I mean, that is the business of acting, really.
I think we found the episode title there, Tennis Ball on a Stick. Love it. Right, I think we've got to leave it there, Lex.
Yeah.
We wanted to discuss what film we're going to watch.
Yeah, we should say what film we're going to do. Because I know that's with Nail and I is one.
That was a suggestion, was with Nail and I. I've never seen that.
It was at the time. I mean, I thought at the time it was a masterpiece. And also I have got some friends who... Go on. There are With Nail and I weekends you can go on now, where you also, because it's partly about, it's an extended kind of drinking session. So there's a bit you have to drink. You drink He drinks lighter fuel at one point, which
fucking hell.
I think presumably you can substitute vodka for that, but
So
it's amazing. I have some stories about a couple of the people in it. I thought it was a masterpiece. What other suggestions are there?
I've heard. Someone suggested Banshees of Inisherin.
Don't know it well enough, really.
Well, that's the point, was we'd watch it. Unlike last time, you didn't watch Edge of Tomorrow. The point is we watch it and then discuss it.
Well, I've seen it. Well, I don't want to.
You've watched Dune 2 14 times, and that's a three-hour film.
Yeah. I don't.
You don't like rewatching stuff.
I don't want to do the Banshee in the Shin. I think
it's too recent as well. I agree. Yeah. I'd rather do Withnail because it is a masterpiece apparently, and I've never seen it. And it's a showcase of great acting performances as well, right?
Yeah.
And I love drinking. Maybe we could get drunk and watch it.
We could match.
Is that the point? Is you're meant to match him drink for drink on screen?
There is a group of people who do that. Yeah,
that sounds wild. No thanks. Yeah. I think my partner likes that film, and would want to watch. Yeah, nodding. Yeah, that she'd want to watch it with me.
Yeah.
But we're not going to talk about it until the first podcast of December.
Okay.
We're going to do a monthly film club. We're not going to give ourselves too much work to do. But it would be great if you watch it and refresh your memory on it at some point.
Okay.
And listeners at home, there's your homework. You've got about 2.5 weeks, 2-3 weeks to watch Withnail. We'll give you a heads up the episode before we discuss Withnail and I.
Okay.
Great. Love it. Withnail it is.
All right.
Any last parting words?
No, I hope this hasn't been a diminution in the sort of energy. I hope this is what people want. I've got quite excited about this. Seems to be a kind of re-energized podcast.
Mate, and so have the listeners. Thank you so much for all the lovely comments and feedback and messages saying we love the yammering, we love the energy, the two of you just going at it. Had a really nice message saying... even though it's so casual and laid back, they still feel the need to concentrate fully. Like they don't like to do their dishes and listen to this. They want to sit down and listen to everyone. Right. I'm like, oh, come on, man, go do your dishes. All it's right. All right. Don't worry, relax. But yeah, we're giving this a go for the next couple months, at least every week.
All right.
Talal and Alexi. Alexi and Talal. 100 episodes. The Alexi Sale podcast. All right. Yeah.
All right. Bye. Bye. You've been listening to the Alexi Sale podcast. This show is produced and edited by Talal Karkouti. Music by Tarbush Records. Thanks to Audio Boom for hosting us. Please keep your emails coming in at alexisalepodcast@gmail.com. Goodbye.